Today on The Nose, our weekly cultural roundtable. Well, first of all, we're in New Haven. That always feels a little different. We're using our Gateway Studios, which means we have New Haven panelists, and we've watched a show on Netflix. It's an episode of the Black Mirror anthology series, but it's a little unusual. It's called Bandersnatch, and it's possible to navigate several different endings. So this is something new, and we will talk about the newness of that. Also, somehow or other, our panelists, as they were emailing around, got into a protracted conversation about whether Imagine Dragons is the worst band in the world. So apparently, we'll be discussing that. Imagine Dragons fans, you should probably turn down the volume during that part. After the news.
Just a young gun with a quick fuse. I was uptight, wanna let loose. I was dreaming of bigger things and wanna leave my old life behind. Not a yes sir, not a follower. Fit the box, fit the mold, have a seat in the foyer.
So that may or may not be the worst band in the world. We'll be discussing that later today on The Nose. I'm not even going to tell you what that band is because I'm just not, so you'll have to wait. We're going to talk about other things also today on The Nose. We've all watched this movie Bandersnatch on Netflix, in which you are constantly being asked to slightly change or choose between two plot options and therefore affect the outcome of it. It's going to be a hard thing to explain to you, I think, if you haven't done it yet or watched it yet or whatever it is that you do. And we're going to begin our conversation with the fact that the Oscars, although this is, I think, still, as they say, a developing story, but it appears right now, according to reporting by The Guardian, is that there might not be any host at all for the Oscars this year, that they might do it by committee somehow. I want to talk a little bit about sort of what that might even imply. But first of all, I have to tell you who I'm going to talk with. Tom Breen is a film critic and reporter for the New Haven Independent and host of WNHH Radio's Deep Focus. Oh, no, I'm not going to have to do Mercy's thing now. I never do it right.
I knew he was dreading it.
I'm white. I don't do this well. Mercy Quay is founder and executive director of the Narrative Project and the host of WNHH Radio's
Work
It Out. It just doesn't work when I do it.
We're going to do this for everyone.
Yeah. Brian Slattery, thank God, doesn't have some peppy show title that I have to mention, at least not here on the outline. Arts editor of the New Haven Independent and producer at WNHH Radio. And for that matter, I mean, you have a band with a catchy name, which I can never remember.
I have a band with a very long name.
Long name.
Do you want me to tell you what it is?
Yeah, what is it? Yeah.
It's Dr. Catterwall's Cadre of Clairvoyant Claptraps.
Yeah.
Really rolls off the tongue.
I mean, I've seen the band.
I think it's, and that's enough,
way better than Imagine Dragons.
And Brian does host a show called Northern Remedy.
Right.
So
Northern Remedy?
Northern Remedy is the name of Brian's show. So all of
that is to come. But let's just talk about this idea of the Oscars. So our story so far was that Kevin Hart was supposed to host the Oscars. Then it came up that in the past he had done some jokes that were homophobic, etc. He did not apologize to everybody's satisfaction, and he is not hosting the Oscars. And he was kind of given a Bandersnatch moment where I think he could apologize like even more.
Yeah.
Or he could just say no to the Oscars, and he clicked on say no to the Oscars. So Mercy, I guess we have to pull that apart. We have to take the Kevin Hart part of it first, and then the whole idea of maybe not having a host at all. So what's your take on...
Yeah, so I also listened to him on Terry Crews yesterday, mm-hmm. and I just don't think he was getting it. You know, there was a point where Terry and him were kind of going back and forth, and Terry was just like, but you understand how some of these jokes aren't funny. He goes, well, I guess, you know, it depends on the speaker. And she goes, no, sometimes these jokes are just not funny. And they were going back and forth. And so I think, I mean, even in the show yesterday, he was saying to her that he apologize profusely to the LGBTQ community, but I don't recall that happening. And what's more is Terry kind of called him out on that. And he was just like, well, was it to their satisfaction? He goes, I did everything I could to their satisfaction. And then once he says, once I did it enough, I stopped doing it. And I was just like, where'd you do it? right? Because because I didn't see it. Who saw it?
You can sort of reasonably ask at this point, then why are people still angry at you?
Exactly. And, you know, I think just from my personal perspective, I don't know who and how to hate right anymore. I there are so many artists that it's like, okay, well, geez, coming back, I think it was this exact Nose group that had the conversation about, is the artist better than their art is bad,
right?
And I there was a point at which that formula was really a go-to for me. I think I have at this point.
It's hard, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exceed
I
the
think that, that's
propriety. Isn't
that is the, a slattery formula? I think
it is.
Yeah.
And
I was, the slattery, you have to sort of look at the artist's worth, artistic worth, and then at the bad stuff that they did, and put them each on one side of a Libra-type scale, right?
Yeah, I guess.
It's your theory, don't say I guess.
Formula, right?
I'm not saying it's great. I'm saying I haven't worked out the details. That's all I'm saying.
Well, Tom, I mean, perhaps I'm alone in all this. I don't know. Maybe I'm alone in all this because I get emails all the time saying, you said, blah, 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 you know, I look forward to your apology. And I was right back and I say, well, I'm not going to apologize. So, because I'm not sorry I said that.
I look forward
and
to
I realize, and I don't say things like what those Kevin Hart jokes were and stuff like that. But it seems like this is like this thing these days, you know, like, well, we look forward to your apology. Where's your apology? How come you didn't apologize? No, you got to apologize. I don't know. Comedians, don't they exist to kind of offend people a little bit?
Well, I love the way that Mercy framed it by not being at a moment where we don't know who to hate, because I think that quite eloquently gets at we have to evaluate each individual case of a, I don't even know how to describe it, a cultural linguistic transgression or something on its own individual merits. I don't think you can follow the same script for every single one of these people who, you know, and there have been a number of people who have been held to the fire because of specifically what they've said on Twitter about a decade ago. I think that maybe what this dilemma really sits at the middle of, for me, is this intersection of our culture's kind of incapacity to accept that people change, and then on the other side, our culture's complete kind of flippant disregard and cruelty towards people who don't belong to the majority identity.
She's like meerkatting you while and, you're talking.
I am. Sorry.
And I think that for Kevin Hart's, you know, specific individual scenario, I think it's really important to remember that detail that you brought up at the start of this conversation, that he was given an opportunity, well, pressured to apologize again for something he said he already apologized for, and he chose not to, even though he later apologized after he'd pulled out of the Oscars. But I think that if he recognized that he should not have said what he said on Twitter 10 years ago once, his the pride that stood between him doing it again, I think is something that does not make me feel like he has been unjustly harmed. If you already know you did wrong, you should be able to, you know, be a man enough to say, I did wrong twice.
Well, I mean, don't even say
it should get easier
enough,
and easier to apologize to some extent.
Right.
You'd be like, right, I know I was wrong.
Yeah.
And now I've known for at least a couple of weeks, I'm more comfortable with the idea.
Right. And I think there needs to be that. You know? There needs to be an out that we agree on. If we are able to develop a catalog of people that we're hating, right, then I think there needs to be a little bit of an index, right? Like, or a bandersnatch option at the end, right?
Like, yeah. Well, also, Mercy, I think this is one of the reasons they're considering not having the Oscars, not having the host for the Oscars, which is that
not having any particular host
for the Oscars, because the host has to set a tone, and it's not just that we don't know who to hate; we also don't know which offenses rise to which level, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the host has to set a tone. So when Ricky Gervais hosts the Golden Globe, he basically comes out there and says, sometimes literally, this is the level I'm going to talk at right now. I'm going to make terrible jokes about you. I'm going to make fun of your pill addictions. I'm going to make sex jokes that make you uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm going to do. This is the tone that I'm going to set. And so maybe Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, maybe they do like a slightly higher tone than Ricky Gervais. But there's no agreed upon tone. In other words, for the Oscars this year, what should you come out and do? Should you be like doing a whole lot of Time's Up Me Too stuff, like really serious stuff like Sandra Oh was doing at the Golden Globes? Or should you be, you know, zinging Mel Gibson the way people used to? Or, you know, I don't think people even agree on that.
Oh, I like Mel Gibson. I just, you know, I'm filled with unpopular opinions, but I think you're right that it's because it's so hard to understand what offense is the offense. We might very well see an Oscars where there's a plethora of hosts who range in, you know, severity of offenses over the last 20 years.
Like, have R. Kelly come out and give the last award of the night?
Oh, wow.
Or Robert Downey Jr., who may has certainly done a lot of it.
Kevin Spacey's coming out. Right.
But I think that is true. There is a breakdown in our common agreement, right? There used to be a time where we all thought, yeah, Billy Crystal, he kind of gets it right. That's about we want somebody to make fun of these people, but not to really shock us. That's about where we want to be.
But here's where I start to feel a little pity for the Oscars, because the Oscars is like your great grandmother, like sitting in the corner of the room where culture just like races ahead of her, and she's just like, how about that Frank Sinatra? Wasn't he great? And I feel like part of it is that institution is so slow moving that it's never gonna catch the moment where it is. Like any decision that they make is just
well, I mean, how many? I think to that point, how many years are we removed from what was it? The Oscars So White. How many years are we removed from that? So I think that three.
Sam Hadelman, who's here in the studio with us, is saying three.
Oh, 3 years. I think that, you know. Yeah. We might find ourselves in you know, maybe a year or maybe, you know, another three where the entire outfit of the Oscars needs to change.
Yeah. You know, I just going back to Kevin Hart's kind of specific situation again, I think that at least that interests me a bit more than whether or not he's hosting the Oscars. That question of how much should we sustain our level of criticism of him today, kind of 8 years or 9 years after the alleged offenses of like hundreds, and these are, I don't know, dozens of tweets that use the word gay and other slurs against LGBTQ people in a very kind of aggressive manner. And I do, my gut says, wait a minute, comedians should be able to say whatever they want. That's what we revere in the Lenny Bruces and the Richard Pryors of the world. But I don't think I can ever stand against people feeling outrage on behalf of an oppressed minority.
Right.
Like if people were legitimately hurt by the language that Kevin Hart used, I want them to come out en masse and say, this is really detrimental to our culture, and I'm not going to back away just because, you know, you want to pursue your career of, you know, incredible celebrity success.
Yeah, I do have to also add here what was kind of funny. So I follow Gary Owen on Instagram. Gary Owen is a self-proclaimed white comedian, and he says he's a white comedian because he usually does stand up on black channels, BET, for instance. So it matters. When this entire story broke, he, you know, used his Instagram and kind of went live and said, "Ellen, you're a pillar of the gay community. Stand up for Kevin Hart." And I was just like, maybe that's not the way to do this. Maybe don't choose the like one of the six gay people you might know and ask them to stand up on behalf of someone. And she eventually did. But I just thought that it was just such a weird positionality for, right, like this white comedian to kind of leverage this other. I mean, it was, the whole thing is weird. And I think that Kevin Hart at this point, you know, he's had some time to stew on it. And I think an appropriate apology or some sort of indication that he understands the issue would suffice.
All right. We need to segue here. And we need to segue to a band that has been accused in a major music publication of being the worst band ever, or at least the worst band in the world. Well, why don't we play a little bit more of them? And while that's happening, I'm going to have Mercy adjust her microphone, and we're going to get – I think we need to deploy Sam Hadelman. We need to release the Kraken here. We have somebody who actually hosts a music show. All right. So here's – so is this the one with Lil Wayne? I'm trying to catch up. So this is the thing where they're actually playing at the football halftime show, except they're not at the football game, right? They're the halftime performance, but they're somewhere else? Yeah, okay. So let's hear a little bit of that. That'll be so much fun for you at home, and we're going to get the microphones right.
You made me a believer. thing. Cause can you imagine what's about to happen? It's Weezy the Dragon, I link with the dragons, and we gon' get ratchet. No need for imagining, this is what's happening. Second thing, second, I reckon the immaculate signs of my accurate. I know the street, don't come with our strategy. I know the sweet, don't come with our cavities. I know the passengers come with some traffic. Start from the basement, end up in the attic. Third thing, third, whoever come me out, they simply can't count. Let's get mathematic, I'm up in this. If you a believer, I get a unicorn out of a zebra. I wear my uniform like a tuxedo. This dragon don't hold his breath, don't need a breather. Love you, Miss Ether, the son of a leader. I know the blooming don't come without rain. I know the losing don't come without shame. I know the beauty don't come without, hold on, hold on, hold on. Last thing last, I know the Tucci don't come without Wayne. I know the losing don't come without.
All right, that's mostly Lil Wayne right there rapping along with a great song, Believer, by Imagine Dragons. So Imagine Dragons have been kind of called out in the press a few times this week. Also, Chris Richards writing in the Washington Post says, has humanity ever listened to so much music against its volition? Imagine Dragons in the gym, Imagine Dragons in the mall, Imagine Dragons in 3 out of 5 movie trailers before the feature presentation, which also features a song by Imagine Dragons. There's too much Imagine Dragons, is his point, and they're not very good. And so they're accused of being, well, basically, Brian Slattery, they're accused of being the new Nickelback, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the new Nickelback, the new Eagles, the new whatever. Here's a good time to deploy my like rock critic poking idea that this is basically a classic example of Freud's narcissism of small differences, in that it's, for a lot of people who like rock music, Imagine Dragons is too close to stuff that they actually like to be comfortable to them. So they're sort of enraged.
Interesting.
By that. And then also it's that Imagine Dragons is really successful. Like, they're really good at making money, and I suspect part of that is, you know, people say, why aren't I making lots of money, or why isn't my favorite act making lots of money? And I can't quite divorce it from that, because I listen to their music as, like, not somebody who's particularly invested in rock music. I listen to it and think, like, these guys are fine. It's fine. It's, you know, it's, well, it's like a paper
fine.
Cup.
It's,
you
okay,
know,
it's like
it's fine.
Right.
It's
right.
Fine.
The small differences theory is a good one. I mean, a 2-seed in the Spirit Presbyterian will have a much worse fight with a 3-seed in the Spirit Presbyterian than he or she will with a Muslim, because there's nothing to argue about.
Totally.
And, you know, backstage there'll be a beef between Lil' Kim's crew and 50 Cent's crew, but probably not between Lil' Kim's crew and the Eagles crew, because they don't have anything to argue about either. But when it gets close, then those differences become important. I don't know. Who else has a cultural theory about this?
I agree with this theory, but I think that it is more detrimental to the culture at large than perhaps you are giving credence to, in that I think that there is
what,
potential.
I think mere
tolerance of mediocre and ubiquitous kind of vacuous teenage rock is like not something that we should promote in constant exposure to the radio.
So tolerating Imagine Dragons is harmful to culture.
I think
are you going to play them all?
He's usually so nice.
This is going to get rough for you.
And well, actually, I don't. So
this is
I do find
mean. I just need that to be clear.
I did love how both critics in the Washington Post and in Spin called out Imagine Dragons as basically artistry by dynamics. It's like you can tell that they are trying to do something different when they play between louder and a lot louder.
I bet those guys love the Pixies, and that's exactly what the Pixies do.
But well, then, so I think this gets at also a key difference between, hey, I'm all about that time in rock and roll history in the late 70s and 80s after punk, when you didn't have to be talented in order to pick up a guitar and drums. I love that stuff, and part of it I think is the message behind it and kind of the feeling behind it, and it's, you know, anti-authoritarian, it's counterculture, it is like aggressively egalitarian. I feel like this stuff is the most heteronormative blah that one could possibly have. I mean, some, you know, bulked up guy from Vegas who I guess he's went to BYU, and that's kind of where the band's formed. He's just constantly singing about being misunderstood as like a handsome, attractive, successful white man who wrote poems and was made fun of a little bit as a teenager. It's just, it's frustrating.
Such a hard
You've
life.
Kind of gone to school on them. All right, Mercy, give us your theory, and then we'll go to
Sam. Okay, again, unpopular opinion. I really like this band. Although I will start by saying that I spent probably a year calling them Chasing Dragons. Which is probably what you have to
see,
do.
See, I'm
to
not here to
them.
Judge you. You can like them. I think it's fine.
Whereas all I'm doing is judging it.
I appreciate it. No, but I do think that you're right, Tom. It I mean, I said in the emails, this is mall music. And, you know, even though the band is, you know, fairly new, newer than when I was going to the mall when I was in my teens, right? It reminds, anytime it comes on, it reminds me of like bouncing in between Forever 21 and Hot Topic, right? The quintessential like mall stores, right? And then getting real angsty as I pop between and deciding what I'm going to wear. Am I going to be like a, I don't know, a Taylor Swift, right? Like a Forever 21, am I getting that today? Or am I going to be hard and edgy, right? Like Katy Perry. And I'm going to go to Hot Topic. That's what this song reminds me of, this band altogether. But also, I have to say, another unpopular opinion, I really liked Creed back in the day. And
there you go.
Since the main character, since the lead singer of this band is like heavily religious, he's Mormon, it sort of reminds me a bit. There's that parallel with
Creed.
Well,
there's a Creed parallel with Creed for sure.
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean, the other thing I think, I started not calling them Chasing Dragons after I watched the HBO documentary about these guys starting the Love Loud festival, which was to get the Mormon church to change their opinions about the LGBTQ community. And then I was like, yeah, this is actually kind of cool. These people are kind of cool.
Yeah, Tom.
Well, I mean, clearly I am in support of that festival. That sounds like a wonderful thing. But nevertheless, as people who are like listening to the music and trying to like dissect how we respond to the, you know, this crazy combination of like lyrics and performance and sounds from all these different instruments, I just feel like this stuff is encouraging an angst and sympathy with something that's just so conventional and boring, and through that is kind of
Tom. Yeah. All right. Everybody
we actually have in the studio, I'm not sure whether this microphone works yet or not, but we'll find out. We actually have somebody who hosts radio music shows and cares about music and is a passionate young person who cares about music. Sam Hadleman is also with us. Everybody here is from WNHH at this point, right? Everybody here at least has one gig there.
Yeah.
So Sam, give us your take.
I'm like somewhere in between Tom
Make
and
sure
Mercy.
You're near Mike, though.
So I'd also like to reject Imagine Dragons is not for teenagers. I am recently out of my teenagehood, and I don't know one other teenager that's like, yo, slap on that Imagine Dragons. That doesn't happen.
First of all, I don't think anyone's saying like, slap on that
Imagine Dragons. No, Imagine Dragons, like, and I understand why they need to be there. You know, rock music isn't selling. You need a big band to sell out arenas that has to be heteronormative and completely normal and not take any risks because that's what sells. That's where rock is at the moment.
Yeah.
Like some four-piece punk, pop punk band out of England that dyes their hair different colors isn't going to sell the amount of records that Imagine Dragons is going
to
sell.
But the thing is, rock doesn't need to sell big in order to survive as like a vibrant musical genre. Maybe it won't be at the top of the charts going forward, but hey, there will still be fascinating rock bands in perpetuity. Fewer people listen to them, but hey, if they are promoting like interesting music,
I don't want it to
cool
be a niche
that.
Art, though. I don't want it to be, I want rock to be popular again, but like, I just don't think, I think that Imagine Dragons has to be there. Like there has, and also the fact that we brought up Nickelback and the Eagles has the best selling album of all time. Nickelback has sold over 50 million records.
Right. And if they were that bad, we wouldn't have ever heard of them.
Yeah.
So I was saying to Brian,
I mean,
this
when
kind
people
of
say this is the worst band in the world. Yeah. I was like, the worst band in the world is like probably like, I mean, you know what these guys are.
Yeah.
It's like three guys in their garage who just bought their instruments.
Right. And one of them is a clarinet.
yes.
But I just want to go back to this for a second because I think it kind of fits in with the Oscar thing too. I think the other thing that's happening is that our musical tastes have become incredibly diversified. You know, of the five of us sitting in this room right now, you know, we don't have very similar playlists. Probably, I don't even want to know what Son Slattery's playlist is. All kind of
really
weird Balkan stuff.
Right. God, I come in here, I'm all like, everything's fine. Yeah.
I named a theory after you. So, I think we have very, very diverse musical tastes. We don't all like the same stuff. But in order to have sort of almost talking points or benchmarks in a conversation, it's helpful to have like the worst band, the band that kind of annoys us the most. And so Nickelback did that for a number of years. Nickelback isn't the worst band in the world. It's just kind of a placeholder for that idea of kind of a corporatized band that sounds okay, that lots of people like, that's playing at the mall until something else is playing at the mall.
I love Nickelback.
I
love Nickelback.
You really do, Sam?
As a kid. Well, because when I came out, I wasn't like in the culture. Like I was 6 years old. So when I'm 6 years old and I'm hearing about big jets and I didn't even know a bathtub could go in a jet until I heard Nickelback. I had no idea. I had a limited access to the internet. I only had VH1. So I grew up listening to like the All American Rejects, The Fray, Nickelback. Like it wasn't until
This is, Wow, I'm just you've changed so much of my perspective on you.
I love everything. Like you really gotta like poke.
See,
me
this is why Sam and I get along.
Yeah, I'm not judgmental at all.
This is also right. Like a music critic shouldn't be saying, "Yeah, I love everything." Gotta
be honest. That's the worst part. That's the worst part. Is that
gotta be honest? This song's great.
You really gotta poke me to be like, "Wow." This
See, I was a music critic. I was a bad music critic because I hated everything. Like I hated almost everything.
I love everything.
I was sitting. My spirit broke. You know what the worst band in the world is, as far as I'm concerned? Journey. I was sitting there in a Journey
playing
concert, and
end.
I said, I cannot do this another minute. I absolutely cannot pretend
I think what I have to add to that is, I didn't think about this until you just said that. Part of what makes me like or dislike a band or a song is how I feel about the people who like or dislike that song, right? If it's like, Journey, for instance, I can't stand Journey because I hate the people who like Journey. Like, and it has nothing to do about the song. I catch myself, right, like humming it sometimes. I'm like, no, I don't like this. I'm not going to like it.
Let me just spell Mercy's Gmail address out for you listening. I don't want that mail coming to me. We're actually going to have to stop there. We're going to play a little bit more Imagine Dragons for you, but we got to switch over to Bandersnatch, which is not a band, by the way, after this. Sky's the limit, I gotta finish at the first rapper on Mars. Mark my word, I'ma make my mark. Even when they start their martial law, even when these Martians alienate my mental state, is still at heart. Oh, look in my eyes, tell me I died, tell me I tried. Took up a mask, tell me you love me, tell me that I don't give up a sky, I barely decide. Wish it could left on my enemies, all of my energy. Go to the almighty God, I can drown in a bottle of Hennessy. A few amenities, I'm getting better with time. I'm waking up. And we're still here. I should say we're in New Haven at the Gateway Studios of WNPR with Tom Breen, Mercy Quay, Brian Slattery. Sam Hadleman is here and can be deployed as necessary, but I don't think he's watched Bandersnatch yet. So we're going to talk now about something that's on Netflix right now. I don't think we'll wreck it for Sam or anybody else who's out there listening. It would be just explaining it will be so incredibly complicated. It seems unlikely that we could spoil it. So we have a science fiction novelist here in our midst. So I'm going to turn it. Do you want me to try to explain it, or do you think you could set it up?
I could set it up.
Okay, set it up.
It's basically like a video version of a choose your own adventure book. Mm-hmm. It's the easiest way to put it. At some point, you're watching the thing. And then the show does a good job of training you of this, actually. So if this concept is unclear, the show is good at teaching you how to do it, which is super cool. But basically what happens is you're watching a thing, and then at any given point, you're given a choice that you have about 10 seconds to reply to, which they eventually use for dramatic effect. You have to say, what do you think that the character should do? And the character is a programmer who's trying to make a video game based on a Choose Your Own Adventure book. So it gets very meta, which is also pretty important to this whole thing. And then, long story short, as the person is trying to finish this project, the programmer is going insane. And it's unclear what things are real and what things aren't. And it gets very fourth wally, you know. They're mm-hmm.
Right. So let me
which
just say
is really cool.
It is set in the early days of video games, so
yes.
Everything
right.
looks very 8-bit.
Right.
And so our protagonist is a young man, Stefan. Stefan is maybe going to have a game produced by one of the big players in the industry, Tuckersoft. And so let's hear a little clip. You're going to hear the head of Tuckersoft and some other people around the office talking to Stefan about this game that he is developing. The game conveniently is called Bandersnatch.
So it's like 3D Monster Maze.
Only when you're moving from choice to choice. It's actually an adventure game.
Like The Hobbit?
Without any typing.
Without any typing? So no get lamp or whatever?
That's right. choices come up on the screen and you pick one against the clock. Okay, he's Pax. He's the demon. He's in the book. So we've actually arrived at a choice point and you can choose with the joystick. You've got 10 seconds.
Worship him.
No, don't do that. He's the thief of destiny. In the book, I mean.
Don't copy this at home. I never got around to reading it.
Well, you should. Jerome F. Davies was a genius.
Didn't he go bonkers and cut his wife's head off?
Well, yeah, but I mean, apart from that, excuse me.
All right, just apart from that. So, yes, there's all kinds of other meta stuff that's going on, or layered stuff that's going on, including the fact that this is all based on a book by whose author also went insane.
But is the book better than he is insane?
Right. Oh, yeah, we have to do the Slattery test on that, too. We haven't read the book. We don't know how to do that. So, So Tom, you know, when we were emailing around about this, Brian used an interesting verb to describe watching Bandersnatch. Bandersnatch is, we should say, an installment in the Black Mirror anthology series. It's available on Netflix, which becomes incredibly important in a way that it doesn't in most things that are on Netflix. But Brian said he played Bandersnatch, and I think that's a really interesting thing, too. Do you watch it or do you play it?
Yeah, and I think that comment helped. This is one of those movies where the first time I watched it, I was very engaged with it just because of the technical novelty of it. But I wasn't quite sure how I felt about it as a movie. But I think that comment really helped me understand why I think this is such a fantastic and innovative and really thought-provoking piece. And this, you know, gets to the history of movies is a long history of experimentation with mm-hmm. Crazy technology, mostly to try to sell stuff. Like maybe one of the most infamous examples is Smell-O-Vision, this technology that released an odor in theaters to mm-hmm. correspond with certain oral marks. I think it may have only been attached to one or two movies in the early 60s. But this could be interpreted as a kind of gimmick, as a way of bringing the audience in to provide some kind of illusion of control, but mostly just to keep them engaged and clicking with their finger on whatever it is that they're holding or with their mouse. But the thing is, the genius of pairing up Charlie Booker and Black Mirror with this technology is that Black Mirror as a series, as a concept, is all about the unintended consequences of our short-term enjoyment of technology going absolutely out of control. And I think to use this really interesting and very different kind of hybrid form of making cinema in a context of just complete paranoid bonkers about the impact of mass culture on our heads was just so interesting to think about, let alone all the different, Variety reported that there are a trillion different permutations of this story. Who knows if that's true, but there certainly are plenty to keep you off of your kind of not feeling stable as you watch it, which is something I appreciate in
although Mercy
in
a lot of it depends on how much you like making decisions, right?
Yeah, no, the folks in this room now know that I have decision anxiety, and so so this has really been preying on my decision anxiety. And I got halfway through it and I was like, I can't decide if you're going to eat Cocoa Puffs versus whatever,
let alone some of the harder ones.
And I was sort of veering towards the easier, right, of the two options, bury him or chop them up. And I'm just like, oh God, oh God, oh God, I don't know. And the time would lapse for me.
Oh, right? So what happens when the time lapses?
They default to an option. And it's always
I never let that happen, Mercy.
Yeah, I know. You don't have decision anxiety.
He's got the nerves of a chopper pilot.
Brian's like, chop them up.
Oh, whatever.
See what
left
happens.
Left choice. I'll pick the one on the left.
Well, I mean, and so, and I think to your earlier point that they definitely train you early on that okay, you need to be paying attention as often as possible. You can't tune out here because
the first couple decisions don't actually matter.
You're choosing what cereal he eats, what drink.
It's just training you
exactly,
to use the thing.
Or what music he's listening is just training you to use it.
Right,
and you can go in any direction, which made me immediately wonder because I noticed that from the beginning. It made me immediately wonder technically how did they work that out? How many different? I mean, I just don't.
There are a lot of really cool technical questions about.
Yeah, so many questions.
Can I ask a technical question too? Okay, so she did it on her phone. How did you watch?
I did it on my laptop.
On your laptop?
Actually, both. Well, first time phone, and then I watched parts of it again on my laptop.
Being an old guy, I watched it on my television, sitting on my couch.
I couldn't watch it on my television because it wouldn't let me. Yeah, it wouldn't let me either.
Do you have an Apple TV? So Apple TV wouldn't let me because you can't interact with it.
I had a Roku box.
Yeah, I got a Roku box. It let me do that. So. But I
they're getting a call from
level
me.
Up.
I think right? that's important though. Me, like man. On my phone, not that I want to be on my phone a lot, but on my phone, I kind of expect to have to make decisions. You know, I mean, I don't know. You're always having to do stuff on your phone.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm sitting in my living room watching my TV. I don't really want to have to do all this. At a certain point, I really felt imposed upon.
Welcome like, to just, decision anxiety.
No, it wasn't decision anxiety. It's just like, entertain me. You entertain me. I don't want to figure this stuff out.
So, I'm happy that you emphatically yelled, entertain me, because there was a little bit of a, are you not entertained moment in the piece. That I loved. It was just like, well, let's back up here. If someone was controlling all of your decisions, wouldn't there be something more entertaining?
Wouldn't this be better?
Right? Yeah. And then
this be better?
And that I was like, oh crap, this is about to be really good.
Now there are a number of meta moments. There's also a moment where Netflix puts its own brand in, which I found maybe the most grating part. Like I did click on Netflix. But what I do think it seems like the clicking while being annoying to some also did encourage a certain type of engagement with a movie that you're just not used to.
Yeah. No.
And I do think that in addition to just like the practical, you have to do this in order to watch it, it got me thinking so much about choice and just like what choice is in this world of technological reality. Choice is a binary thing. It's a zero or it's a one. It's a clicking on the left side of the screen or the right. But in fact, the choices that this character makes, that we make him make, are radically different between serials is not the same as between who's going to kill themselves, you or the person you're standing next to.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is, if this movie has a thesis through both form and content, it's like choices, despite the illusion that choice is just a matter of doing yes or no, actual human like interactions and morality and stuff are a lot more complicated than one or zero. So don't fall under the spell of like, click, now I'm done for the day. These are two radically different types of things that you're being asked to do, and don't forget about the difference.
Well, Brian, also, you know, they're sort of sucking us into the auteur process a little bit too. And I think as you were playing this too, you have to sort of on the spot, not knowing too much about this the first time you play it, you try to make decisions about, well, what sort of story is this? You know, is it a story that comes out well? Does it come out badly? Does Stefan get 5-star rating for his game? Is that what I should be trying to collaborate with this algorithm on?
Right. I mean, I had the most fun with Bandersnatch when I was thinking about what decisions will make for the most, what I think might be the most interesting story. So it meant sort of like whenever there was a detour, I took it. Whenever there was a sort of like slightly counterintuitive decision, I made that. Because I was just thinking, like, I wonder what this thing, like, that it's presenting me with these things suggested, like, these will be interesting detours. And usually that was true. There were a couple of cases where they were like, well, that was dumb. You shouldn't have done that. But that's fine. I mean, and that was part of, I think that was part of the, I keep calling it a game, and I guess I'll stick with it. That was part of the game, too. Like, it was fun to figure out, like, how much information I was supposed to know at any given point. Like, when I did it again, I was actually sort of punished for, like, trying to skip ahead.
So I just want to play one more clip here. There's a moment at which Stefan knows, quote unquote, that maybe there's somebody there with a little Roku remote or a phone or something that is causing him to do things. So this is one of these mini meta moments. He happens to be talking to his psychotherapist at the time. Here's how that sounds.
I don't know if it's the deadlines, but my head is all over the place. I keep having these vivid dreams, like thinking weird things.
What sorts of things?
Like, I'm not in control.
Of?
Anything. Little things, tiny decisions, what I have for breakfast in the morning, what music I listen to, whether I shout at Dad or...
You feel like you're not making these decisions?
I feel like I'm not guiding them, like someone else is.
You're not hearing voices or...
No voices, but there is something. I don't know, an impulse? I'm sure there is.
Okay, the fact that you're aware of your mental state is actually reassuring. But it sounds like you're starting to dissociate, so we want to nip that in the bud before you start to seriously entertain delusions. I don't think we're there yet, though.
You know, Mercy, one thing that Tom said as we were emailing around is that, you know, I hope I'm summarizing this correctly, but in a way, because we wind up paying attention to this format and, you know, and this unusual thing that we're doing, they aren't really the most richly developed characters in the world.
No, they're very weak. One thing that was absolutely not developed enough for me is, okay, so he's a 19-year-old gamer. in therapy for what and why and how. There's not enough. We're supposed to be, you know, this is the person that we're supposed to be most familiar with. This is the character that we're supposed to be most familiar with in the film. And we still don't know very much about him. I think all of the characters were weak. And it has to be, kind of. I think it would be very difficult for us to, we would start to internalize everything that we know about a character when we needed to choose a decision about their next path. Like, oh, what would so-and-so do? And the reality is we don't know. And so it's the decisions left on us. And I think that was a really great way to do it.
So the lead character is played by, I'm probably going to mispronounce his name, but Fionn Whitehead, who many people last saw in Dunkirk, the Christopher Nolan movie, where he played an absolute kind of cipher. Like, he had no personality. He was just kind of this cog in this much larger, more traumatic war machine that allowed the audience to experience all these incredible sights and sounds and choices that everyone around him. He's the, you know, literally kind of faceless person in the crowd experiencing this. And while I also, I stand by earlier comment and agree with you, Mercy, that the character development is not one of the
finer points.
I really love the character played by Will Poulter, who is Colin Pittman, who is this, you know, same age, maybe a little bit more advanced in his technological prowess.
The Yoda character is really Yoda,
he's the goo- but it's... he's also, I mean, he is also the gatekeeper to this world of, you know, someone refers to the doors of perception. Yeah, both through drugs and through technology, you pull away whatever blinders you have and you see the world as it is. But in fact, he is not the gatekeeper to any kind of truth. He's the gatekeeper to this horrifying conspiracy that is wrapped up in his own kind of paranoia and mental illness that then infects, you know, fine. Why did Black Mirror, I feel like, is rarely about an actual government experience, conspiracy to control people. It's all about, you know, horrible, again, side-on effects from short-term decisions.
We make our own hells. We have to stop right there to have time for recommendations and endorsements on the other side. So let's do that. It's Bandersnatch. You're just not a participant of 2019 if you don't do it. We don't care whether you have fun or not.
So you better get ready. Ready to go. You can come as you are. Pay as you go. Pay as you go.
Today's show is produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf, or by Paul Manafort and five Ukrainian oligarchs. Okay, you picked the second one. That means Amanda Fish is a political prisoner and all of our interns are dead. The part of Bill Curry was played by Patti LaBelle or R. Kelly. You picked R. Kelly. Man, you're making bad choices. There probably won't be a Monday show, but tune in and check anyway. And now, back to Colin.
All right, here we are. We're back. We're back in the Gateway Studios at Gateway Community College, WNPR's southern home, the Mar-a-Lago of WNPR, some people say. And so,
it's, give them my email.
Right, yes. Right. People are saying.
So, Brian Slattery, what are you going to recommend?
There are two albums that I find myself listening to incessantly. One of them is by No Name. She's a MC out of Chicago. Her latest album is called Room 25. If you like jazz, if you like D'Angelo, she's great. Okay. And she also has a flow that's like super interesting. It's kind of mesmerizing and great. And she's really smart and really funny. And then along similar lines is an album called Exoskeletons for Children. And it's by an artist called Squaloscope. And it's sort of the same idea where it's this like songwriting that's kind of it's definitely influenced by hip hop a lot, but she like takes it in a whole other kind of direction. She's European, and there's something really compelling about the way she puts her music together. So yeah, No Name and Squaloscope.
All right, what do you got, Tom?
Okay, I'm also going to make two. Well, first, Cross endorsed the No Name album. I love that. Two very quick recommendations. So every New Year's, I get to go to my wonderful partner's family's place in Detroit, which is where she grew up. And one of my favorite things to do each year is just read a bunch of stuff about Detroit and listen to a bunch of stuff about Detroit, because it's like the American city, which can go on for a number of hours about. But two Detroit recommendations. One is called Crime Town. It's the new season in a series put out by the Gimlet Podcast Network that is like a 20 episode or something investigation into, the first one was into Providence, Rhode Island, and the administration of Buddy Cianci. This one's focused on the mayoral administrations of Coleman Young and Kwame Kilpatrick. Looks at the intersection of organized crime and politics, but really it's just a fascinating look at Detroit in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s. A lot to mine there. The second one, maybe a bit of a harder sell, but it's called Detroit Resurrected to Bankruptcy and Back, and it is a fascinating book by a Detroit reporter named Nathan Bromey about Detroit filing for bankruptcy in 2013 and how they got out of bankruptcy a little over a year later. This, you know, it may sound like daunting subject matter to people who don't rack their heads all the time thinking about, I don't know, pensions and debt obligations and stuff like that. But if Detroit is really the city that is like the harbinger of all other things that every other city is going to go through at some point, it is a really interesting and detailed look at how Detroit wound up radically restructuring the finances of its city government and also affecting every part of municipal services in that city. So Detroit Resurrected, really interesting book.
Mercy Quay, what have you got for us? It's going to involve outer space somehow.
It will. So starting with today is Alexander Hamilton's birthday. So listen to the Hamilton soundtrack. Just go ahead and do that. Escalating up to Travelers, season 3 of Travelers is now on Netflix, and you can binge watch it because there's 3 seasons. Travelers is a series about a dystopian future in which humans ruin the Earth, right? And it's kind of going to happen. And they have time travelers, i.e. travelers, sent back to the 21st century to save the future. That kind of show. It's really interesting. Take the weekend. You're welcome. And then last night, I went up to what is considered to be the best and most advanced planetarium in the state. It is in Glastonbury, the Glastonbury Planetarium. Surprisingly enough, I hadn't been there yet, but it opened in about 2013. They recently did an update this past fall, and it is the most advanced planetarium in the state. Right now, they're showing what they're showing is about the lunar eclipse that will happen on the 21st. So if you want to learn about lunar eclipses before you watch the lunar eclipse in real time, visit the Glastonbury Planetarium.
I had no idea there was a Glastonbury Planetarium.
Yeah.
All right. Sam, do you have anything? Yeah, he's ready.
Yeah, I got two albums, In the Breath of Brian, Saba, Care for Me. It's kind of a jazz record out of Chicago, out of the Chicago scene that he was talking about, No Name. I'll just say it's kind of about grief. Fantastic record, blew me away.
And say the name again?
Saba, Care for Me.
All right.
And then the second one I'm going to recommend is Victory Lap by Nipsey Hussle. It just got nominated for a Grammy. If you're into kind of like the Dr. Dre West Coast era, it's really interesting. He's an independent artist. My tagline is that he sold a free mixtape for $1,000 and made $100,000.
Wow.
All right. Those are from Sam Hadelman, a special guest appearance here today on the news. I'm going to recommend actually kind of a bad podcast, but I think you need to listen to it anyway. So it's called Bagman, and it's produced by MSNBC and hosted by Rachel Maddow. It is her project. They do not have any idea how to make podcasts. I mean, they're like really down. And so they sort of try to deploy all of the things that they do on television. So like there's always like trumpets and snare drums and stuff to tell you that something really important is happening. They don't kind of understand some of the more quiet intimacy of podcasts, and Rachel is also telling you things that you're really going to like and things that are really going to be important, as if you can't figure those things out for yourself. So why am I recommending this, other than like I want Nick Kwa, who's on this show sometimes, to just sit and listen to this podcast with me so we can figure out all the tropes that it violates. Well, it's interesting to listen to on that basis if you like form, you know, and like it sort of shows you how not to do this, but it's also really important because of what it's about. It's about the case that was brought by the Justice Department against Spiro Agnew simultaneously with the Watergate case. So you have a sitting vice president who is like really committed sort of grotesquely obvious criminal acts. I mean, at a very sort of unbelievably crude, shall we say, state of Maryland type level, and just brought that whole act to the White House, envelopes full of cash and stuff like that. But he has something approaching the full arsenal of the federal government to try to fight this off with, or at least a high-ranking position, vice president, within the federal government. And one of the things that it makes clear to you right away is this: you can do this. You know, if you're wondering whether it's possible to have somebody who has a very prominent office in the White House or the old executive office building who has committed crimes, whether it is possible to go after that person, yeah, the answer is yes. It takes a certain kind of courageous prosecutor. It takes probably an attorney general of the magnitude and integrity of Elliot Richardson, but it really can be done. And there's some incredibly interesting and funny stuff on the podcast. So even though it's not a very good podcast, I think you should listen to it because it really speaks to a lot of issues that are percolating right this very moment here in American life. And I think I'll stop there other than to say it's been a lot of fun to be here. This is kind of a rowdy nose. I like the rowdiness of the nose. So thanks to special guest star Sam Hadleman, to the wonderful Brian Francis Slattery and Tom Breen and Mercy Quay. And thanks to Jonathan McPants for coming down here and getting this whole thing all set up for us. And we're going to be back unless some Black Mirror Bandersnatch thing happened and we made a bad choice. Otherwise, we'll be back on Monday.